Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. Can you unpack the changes happening in U.S. politics by examining one small town in Ohio? For New York Times bestselling author Beth Macy, the answer is yes, and it's personal. Her hometown of Urbana has changed in so many ways in recent years that Macy says she does not recognize it. She says the Urbana of her youth was not utopian, but it also was not so starkly divided. Today, author and journalist Beth Macy joins us to talk about our country's political divide through the lens of Urbana, Ohio, and to talk about her new book, Paper Girl, a memoir of home and family in a fractured America. Beth Macy, welcome to All Sides.
Hi, Amy. Nice to meet you.
So this book is part memoir and part reporting project, and you are the paper girl in the title. So, of course, I wanted to start with you. You say that if you had been born 10 years later, you would not have been able to go to college and you would not be the person you are today. Why do you think that?
Because I was able to go to college for free in 1982 through 1986. I went to Bowling Green State University, a state four-year college, and the Pell Grant, because we were so poor, covered the entirety of my tuition, room and board, and books. And it was the only way I could have gone. Today, that would only pay about 30% because of the government's underfunding of higher education and skyrocketing tuition. So we know that the typical Pell Grant students pays off that money through their increased taxes in 10 years' time. And I certainly have paid off the government's investment in me many, many times. So I often think about that because I just think, gosh, where would I be?
Yeah, you write that you think the Pell Grant saved your life. Do you feel that Pell Grants are not quite saving a life nowadays?
Definitely. I mean, I watched so many kids struggle even just to go to community college, and they didn't have the supports to get there, you know, hour-long commutes in the rural countryside. You got to have a decent, reliable car. I mean, we're really just shooting ourselves in the foot by not making it easier for kids to get jobs that are going to help them be productive citizens and to be healthy and happy.
Let's talk about how this book came about, Paper Girl. When did you start to realize the Urbana of your youth and the Urbana of today were two different places?
Yeah, I started going home more often around 2015 when our mom was diagnosed with dementia. And she no longer lived in Urbana, but she lived nearby in a little town called Enon. A lot of my relatives still lived in Urbana. And some of the first things I noticed, especially during Trump's first term, was that this town that I loved so much growing up, that I feel like the town kind of partially raised me between the library down the street and the teachers at my schools, it was once a place just that was celebrated for being an important stop on the Underground Railroad. It's a very old little city founded in 1805 and lost a lot of people, a lot of Union soldiers in the Civil War. And we were really proud of that. And suddenly when I started going home more, I noticed there were Confederate flags flying. And I'm like, huh. And then I noticed that every conversation I was having with my family, like politics would intrude. And I'd ask my brother, for instance, my brother-in-law, how he was doing, and he would say, deplorable, and, you know, want to get in a battle with me. My brother unfriended me on Facebook around 2017 because of, quote, all the liberal crap I post, which were fact-checked articles from the New York Times and Washington Post. Some of those, my articles. And, you know, then in 2020, as our mother was dying in a memory care facility, it was happened to be the day of that they were counting the votes after the Biden election in 2020, and they hadn't yet announced it. And when they did, the hospice nurse announced it. Mom was literally breathing some of her last breaths. and my evangelical sister, Cookie, who had never really expressed political views before when we were together, shouts out, "It's fraudulent. You wait. He won't win." And I just thought, wow, what is happening to my family, my hometown, my country? And I wrote a piece about it. It ran in the New York Times, you know, more of that quote liberal crap that I post. And basically hundreds of people responded in an hour. And I thought, oh, wow, I'm not the only one. We now know 1 in 5 Americans is estranged from their families because of politics.
Yeah, your mom died in 2020 shortly after Biden was elected. And that's around the time, I believe, that you decided to turn this into just being inquisitive and actually turn it into a reporting project. So I guess you can say, though, that you were reporting this book your whole life because it is the life you lived. But when did you actually start deciding, I'm going to do interviews, this is going to be a book?
Yeah, I think the interviews began in late 22. Mm-hmm. I sold the book proposal, and it was meant not to be a straight memoir. It was meant to be heavily reported look at how we got here to this point of fracture. And so about a third of the book is my personal story, my journey out of poverty. A third of the book is the story of a young me that I found who was a promising poor kid, you know, decent grades and a leader in the marching band, which also I always say kept me out of jail. You know, I had such fun, and it was just such a great, healthy thing to be in community and to be so close to my band director. And then a third of the book is really a hard look at the town, not just my friends, but also just the power structure and how it works, how the schools are doing. And a lot of what I found was just really shocking to me.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with New York Times bestselling author Beth Macy about her new book, Paper Girl, a memoir of home and family in a fractured America. So let's back up and talk about Urbana for a few minutes. One of the better jobs your mom had when you were younger was working for the biggest employer in town, Grimes Manufacturing. There at the time, there was a time when every airplane made in America used lights manufactured in Urbana, Ohio, and they were made by Grimes Manufacturing. Mm-hmm. So tell me about that employer and what happened when that employer went away.
Well, it didn't go entirely away. It got sold and resold and resold. And, you know, at its peak in World War II, I think they had 1,400 employees. Now they have 650. So it's still a growing concern, a going concern. But, you know, it's now headquartered. The economic developer in town didn't even know where it was headquartered. It's called Honeywell International. And, you know, a lot of the jobs that my mom did were either replaced by technology or offshored, and she basically soldered airplane lights. But you would hear a lot of talk about old man Grimes, and he was Warren G. Grimes, the guy who, you know, he was a ninth grade dropout and an orphan at one point, and he loved the Wright brothers. He kind of was witness to the early aviation days, and he started it out of a garage and just was fabulously successful. And he ran the town. I mean, he was mayor for a time. He gave away to the best students who were employees' kids scholarships to Ohio State University. He helped launch the hospital that I was born in 1964, you know, gave free haircuts. It was very paternalistic and all the bad and good that comes with that.
So old man Grimes, you said he was mayor, but he really helped Urbana, too. Is that love for a town from one influential person who cares? Is that missing from Urbana or small towns in general today?
I think it is. I think so many of our companies have been sold, and you know, as I was reporting the story, one of the biggest employers, which was Johnson Welded Products, was sold to a company that was elsewhere. I mean, they're still there, but what you're missing is those local people that go to work and run the place and are also members of the Kiwanis Club and, you know, the Lions Club and give away scholarships and things of that nature. And there are smaller manufacturers, yes, but most of them aren't headquartered there anymore.
You wrote a piece about your book for The Atlantic, and in it you said that there are two Americas, wealthy cities and suburbs where parents are obsessed over their children's school, and then poor towns and rural communities where college is largely unattainable. But isn't there a case that at least part of Urbana, not the entire city, is in poverty, correct? There is that parents obsessed with their children's school part.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I wanted to make sure I wasn't just doing the N of one thing and profiling these kids who weren't doing well, right? Because I was, you know, the kids I chose weren't the worst kids, but they had a lot of challenges. But when you looked at the hard data, and I was really doing a comparison from when I left in 1986 and now roughly 40 years, you know, I got this straight from the police chief and the fire chief. Mental health emergency calls have multiplied by a factor of 9 in 40 years. The graduation rate of the high school had gone down 12 points in a decade. Homeschooling was huge. Truancy was through the roof. And food stamps had doubled. It, by every socioeconomic measure, people in Urbana were doing worse, but it is these two layers. It is the professional class and the upper middle class whose kids are going to go to college regardless and probably aren't coming back unless they have a family business or a family farm to run. And then what you're left with the hollowed out middle class was the low wage class, or the class that isn't even able to work. And neither of those extremes knew what the other was happening, because there's no local news really to tell those stories anymore. So I would go home and I would stay with my friend Betty, who is a prominent business person, minority owned business, very, very successful, her family business. And I would tell her these things I was witnessing all day long when I would see her every night for dinner, and she would just be stunned about the truancy level, and she didn't know about the graduation rate. Now, the parents in that upper professional class, a lot of them had pulled their kids out of Urbana schools and were sending them to an adjacent, more rural district that was less impoverished, more farming. We know farming communities in general have done a little better. Most communities that didn't have all their eggs in one basket, one kind of factory that was, you know, susceptible to offshoring and things like that, have done better economically. This is true over decades. And so when you pull your kid out of Urbana High and send them to West Liberty, that money goes with the kid. And then add to that the number of people that are homeschooling. It's now the fastest form of education in the country. And it's really a hard hit financially for Urbana schools.
Since we're here in Ohio and we're talking about Ohio, is West Liberty also in Champaign County, or where is it in relationship to Urbana? I forgot to look it up.
That's fine. It's about 15 minutes north.
Okay. Yeah. So in your book, you quote someone as saying that Urbana is the country club and the ghetto, and neither knows that the other exists, right? So, yeah. That's okay. Yeah. So how has the country club side of Urbana reacted to your book? Have you heard any reaction?
Not a lot. A lot of people showed up for my book launch in Urbana. Sorry, had some water down the wrong pipe. And it was a couple days before the book came out. That was something my publisher set up. It wasn't intentional. The country club set, I don't really know. A friend of mine said his mother-in-law, who's in her 90s, went to her book club, and nobody wanted to read it. In fact, one was going to take it back to the bookstore. <Uh-oh>. Yeah. But I've heard from all the people that I know and I care about, they've been very nice about it. I mean, I'm talking about school teachers and librarians and counselors. The people who really know what's going on appreciate a little light being shown in where the needs are, because they really love their town and they want to make it better. It's likely that the leadership class, want to, quote, kill the messenger. But I haven't really heard directly from them, so I shouldn't answer that question. I don't really know.
Oh, okay, so it's not like you didn't get a scathing email from the mayor.
I didn't, no. The villagers haven't yet come for me.
You did interview the mayor for the book, though. Did he know the premise, and did he know that you were going to talk about, like, the the Urbana of your youth versus now?
Oh, absolutely. I was very transparent. I interviewed him numerous times, recorded. Yes.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking with New York Times bestselling author Beth Macy about her new book, Paper Girl, a memoir of home and family in a fractured America. Beth is with us for the hour today, and coming up, we're going to talk about the youth of Urbana today and what they need to succeed and what's missing. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Urbana, Ohio has a population of about 11,000 and is located 40 miles west of Columbus. According to author Beth Macy, over several decades, Urbana has changed. Employers have left. Chronic absenteeism has skyrocketed. There are increasing rates of addiction and suicide. A town that was once the stop on the Underground Railroad now flies Confederate flags. Today, author and journalist Beth Macy is with us to talk about our country's political divide through the lens of Urbana and through her new book, Paper Girl, a memoir of home and family in a fractured America. Beth, thanks again for being here.
Thanks, Amy.
So a thread throughout your book, besides your life, is a young man named Silas James. You have said that in other interviews, you said that you were looking for a modern day you, a promising poor kid. So how did you find Silas?
I found him by talking to teachers and counselors at the school, and he was the name that came up the most often. And I think we initially did a Zoom interview, and then I would go home for a week, a month, for 2 years, and I would meet with them every time I went home. Sometimes I'd meet him at his college class, other times in Urbana or at his home.
I did not realize how important a car is in a rural town like Urbana. You are car dependent. You need that car, and you need a car that works. Tell me about Silas and car problems.
Yeah, so he got two full scholarships for to go to community college. He was in this one program. He wanted to become a welder because he was, his teacher advised if you go to a four-year college, even though he had the intellectual chops for it, it would just be too much student debt because, again, that Pell Grant problem, the Pell purchasing problem we talked about earlier, it not covering the full freight anymore. So he gets these double scholarships at Clark State, but he doesn't really understand that. I mean, his mind, the ideal world, the first scholarship would pay the tuition, the other would help him pay for a decent car to get there, or pay for an apartment nearby so he wouldn't have to commute an hour each way. At the time, he was living with his mother in Marysville, so it was a full hour to Clark State in Springfield. And so the very first week, his starter fritzed out and stranding him in Springfield. And then he finally gets home, and then the next day, his mother gets a car accident, has a severe concussion, can't be left at home alone. So Silas ends up being the caregiver, and he drops out the first week. Now, eventually he gets back in that fall. That was the summer term I was just talking about. He gets back in that fall. And over the course of 10 months that he's doing this program, he has to work full time to help with the family's expenses. He has a 2-hour commute, counting getting there and getting back. And he goes through, I think it was 5 clunker cars and 4 jobs. Mm. And every time I would speak to him, there would just be all this drama going on. Mm. And I would just be like, whoa. And he's like, no, I'm used to it. That's the way it's always been. Mm. But he persevered. I mean, I sat in those welding classes with him, and he was like the best welder in class by far. His teacher was really impressed with him. But, you know, this kid had been through so much trauma. His family was still kind of dragging him down. And he didn't have that experience that you and I probably had, where our parents drop us off at college and we don't see him again till Thanksgiving. He's got to go home. He's got to help get dinner ready for the kids. And I just don't know if I could have handled that.
Another element here is that Silas James is a trans man who is an excellent student, but had to grow up very fast due to an extremely dysfunctional family, as you said. Did Silas find acceptance in Urbana?
You know, he really did. And that surprised me. When I asked the teachers about it, they would say, well, you know, we have about 25% of our students identify as LGBTQ. And I interviewed several of them. They all seemed like they weren't being picked on or bullied at school. Nor did Silas. It was very clear. Like, I remember in eighth grade, Silas was told that all females had to wear a dress to the eighth grade graduation ceremony. And he just very calmly walked up to the principal and said, I'm not doing it. And the principal said, I'm not going to make you. So the teachers, again, are the heroes of the story, and they really looked out for him. And as with me, they kind of became a functional family when his own wasn't up to the task.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with New York Times bestselling author Beth Macy about her new book, Paper Girl, a memoir of home and family in a fractured America. I wanted to talk more about the youth in Urbana, addiction, trauma, and poverty. That's all a continuing theme in the book. And it's keeping kids from going to school regularly. You write that kids do not respect school. They don't fear consequences of not going to school. And if they're truant, their parents just homeschool them. And I'm using air quotes around homeschool for part of it. Can you tell me more about the chronic absenteeism problem that Urbana has?
Yeah, that really blew me away. I spent a lot of those weeks when I would be home. I would take one day almost every time and shadow the school attendance liaison, a woman named Brooke Perry, who would just, you know, she put like 115,000 miles on her car in a couple of years, driving from one end of the county to the other, picking up kids, taking them to school, arguing with parents who weren't getting up in the mornings to send their kids to school. Providing a ton of social supports, but this district needed about 10 of her. And one thing Ohio did, I think it was in 2023, is they deregulated homeschooling, which meant that no longer did a retired teacher or some education expert have to sign off on the curriculum for homeschool students. And instead, it was just a one page, simply a statement that I'm gonna be homeschooling. And one parent actually gave Brooke, the truancy officer, a note on a post-it note, and that was all she bothered filling out. One house that we went to identified, it was a beautiful farmhouse out in Champaign County, identified as sovereign citizens, which means they don't pay taxes, even though they drive on our roads, et cetera. And they certainly don't send their kids to school. And there were warrants out for them for not doing any of the paperwork. I think this is one of the worst unintended consequences of that bill that the legislature passed, is that loophole, that lack of eyeballs on these homeschoolers and what they're being taught, resulted in a family who isn't up to the task of getting their kids up in the morning, but wants to avoid being charged for truancy, gives them an easy out. They can pull their kids out if the kid's having discipline troubles in school, or if the truancy officer is knocking on their door too many times and say, forget it, I'm homeschooling. And then there's no check on it.
Did you find more so it was that the kids didn't like school, or is it a parenting problem of with making the kid go to school?
Probably a little bit of both, but I mean, honestly, when I was coming up, was there any like notion that you wouldn't want to go to school? I loved school. School was the place where I felt the most valued, the most myself. You know, I got to experience success. And so I think part of it is that hollowing out of the middle class. There were fewer kids that Silas could look to who were gonna go to college, who were gonna go away. There just aren't as many now as there were when I was coming up. And also, he didn't have their parents to sort of be substitute parents for him. I had a lot of friends' parents that helped raise me. I had a mom, Helen Wellman, who made me lunch every day. We would go home. She would make tuna salad, chicken salad. Then she'd go back to tuna salad, chicken salad. And her dad had been an alcoholic. And so she could tell, like, without asking, if I was having a rough day because things were hard at home, and would give me a hug and talk to me about it. And all these kinds of things, you know, it's all about relationships that you have with healthy adults in the community, whether that's a teacher, a librarian. You know, I worked at the city pool in summers after I stopped lifeguarding and I wanted to make a little bit more money. And, you know, I was friends with the judge who would come every day after work and swim laps during break. Judge Wilson, his wife was Lynn, the librarian down the street from me. And these were the kind of people I knew, and I wanted to be like them when I grew up. And that there's just no substituting for these extra eyeballs that are looking after you.
Yeah, I guess we should say earlier, I mentioned that you found school as a refuge. You say that, you know, the Pell Grant saved your life, but also you had a dysfunctional home. You had your older siblings are older than you. Your mom worked very hard and tried very hard. And your dad was an alcoholic, right?
Yeah, and pretty dysfunctional by the time I was a teenager, not working. So it really all fell on mom. And I had a grandma next door, my dad's mom, who was just incredible. She taught me how to read when I was four and spoiled me and owned our house, which kept us from being homeless some of the time. But mom worked at the factory at Grimes, soldering airplane lights. And, you know, when the economy would get bad, she would have to pick up under the table work, babysitting or waitressing badly, she said. And it really fell to her. But compare my situation with Silas's. He didn't even have one stable parent. He didn't have a grandmother next door. I think his grandmother did raise him for a time when he was very little, and she died when he was nine. So it was like everybody that was supposed to take care of him abandoned him in some way. So he was also really good at doing the Eddie Haskell thing and making other friends' parents role models. There just weren't as many of him, many of those kinds of people in Urbana left.
You are also the author of the critically acclaimed book Dope Sick, where you chronicle how Purdue Pharma got Americans addicted to opioids and made off with the money. You say in Paper Girl that people did not know what they did not know. They did not know about the drug problem in Urbana until it was too late. Is this the same thing that's happening with the youth in Urbana, with them missing school? People don't know enough about the problem, and it's going to be too late once they don't know the chronic absenteeism rate?
Exactly. I mean, there's been a tiny bit of reporting, but the Urbana Daily Citizen, which is down to, I think, 1.5 full-time reporters, 1.5 reporters, mainly high school sports, and people are sending in press releases. Most people get their news there from Facebook. I mean, I would consider it a news desert. And we know that Trump in 24 won 91% of the counties that lack a source of fact-check professional news. And so what happens is people get their news from Facebook and Meta and these information silos. And a lot of the fact-based news is behind paywalls now and harder to access. So I think I was really surprised by the level of misinformation, even among some of my oldest, dearest friends who believe George Floyd wasn't killed by Derek Chauvin, who believe children are identifying as cats and bringing litter boxes to school, who believe President Biden, he was president at the time when I was doing the interviews, is dead and that's an actor playing him with a face mask on. I mean, just like stunning things to me. And I mean, so many people, like my sister Cookie at our mom's deathbed, believe the election of 2020 was stolen. And, you know, we know that's been completely debunked.
Yeah. And related to the youth in Urbana, you write a heartbreaking detail that the teen suicide attempt rate was now outnumbering the drug overdoses. Tell me more about this crisis with teens in Urbana.
Well, you saw it with Silas the first week when he had to drop out. He tried to commit suicide. Maddie has had a lot of struggles with mental health, has been hospitalized a number of times. She's another student I spent a lot of time with. Grace is my positive story. You know, she dropped out. She was, she's slightly autistic, but very smart. She dropped out her senior year of high school and found refuge at the Urbana Youth Center. She had zero credits. She hadn't passed a single class in all of her high school career when she dropped out. And, you know, month by month, day by day, going to the youth center, learning how to pass the GED, learning how to human skills, you know, she did really good and she passed. And she's now employed and she has her own apartment and she's not living on the floor of a skanky motel room in Springfield where she was abused. And, you know, she told me, actually, I found out I'm quite smart. And it, just such a story about relationships. These people at the youth center took her under their wing. And there was one young woman, the program director, Natalie Yoder, who was actually a certified foster parent. And when Grace was 18 and living in this motel with her parents, Natalie said, Grace, you can come and live with my husband and I if you'd like. And Grace had never slept on sheets before. I mean, she had to tell her that she didn't have to get her food out of the trash. She could use the food that was in the refrigerator. And when I asked Grace where she thought she would be without the Urbana Youth Center, she said, I'd either be dead of suicide or living under a bridge somewhere.
That phrase you used a minute ago, you used throughout the book, where they need someone to teach them how to human. I found that interesting. Is that so? It's more so than just learning, you know, the basics that you need to learn in school to pass the test. There's a lot of youth in Urbana that need to find someone who's going to teach them how to human.
Yeah, and that's the kind of stuff I saw happening at the youth center. I mean, they teach them how to get work skills, how to run a weed eater, how to mow grass, how to use a broom. Some kids didn't know how to use a broom or a hammer. And when the school counselor told me, she's the one that first brought up how to human, because I'm like, what do you mean? She goes, well, they don't know. If they forget to bring a pencil to class, they'll say to the teacher in front of everybody, I forgot my pencil, instead of you or I would have just asked a friend to borrow one, right? Mm-hmm. Like just kind of basic communication skills. Going back to the basics. And when Chris Flowers, the counselor I was just talking about, would bring employers in to talk to the kids about maybe going into a trade program or maybe doing this half day work, half day school program, the kids would want to know, well, how many days is it okay to miss in the first 6 months? Mm-hmm. And Chris would be like, be quiet. It's not okay to miss any. You don't want them to think that you're not going to show up. And that was something I heard over and over from the managers in Urbana. I asked one, I said, if you hired 10 people today, how many would still be here in 6 months? And he said, maybe one. And we'd probably have an attendance issue with him. Mm. Turnover rate. The absenteeism in the workplace was just as bad as the absenteeism at school.
Yeah, and somewhere in the book, you talked about the youth in Urbana and say that they don't seem to know that if they get a job, they can get out of the life that they're in. Like if they get a job and keep a job, then they can get out of that life. They don't seem to have the desire for it. Why is that? Does that go back to the not knowing how to human?
Yeah, and maybe... I mean, I don't know. A lot of people at that level of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, they're just surviving. Look, I showed up today. What more do you want from me? They are just grasping to survive, and they don't know people personally who have figured a way out, because not that many people are in their world. I'm trying to have like a heart for them and even a heart for the parents who aren't able to get them up and send them off to school because of their own mental health and addiction issues. When I interviewed the doctor at the Federally Qualified Health Center, who is a young, grew up on a dairy farm outside of Urbana, went to OSU Medical School, comes back to serve her rural hometown. She says she was the first doctor they hired because it's a new facility. In 6 months, in the first couple of weeks, they were booked out for mental health and substance use disorder for 6 months, but they still save two slots every week for suicidal calls. I mean, they know that they're going to come up. And, you know, I say, how do you stay upbeat? And she says, well, we celebrate the small wins, like somebody just showing up for their appointment, for somebody getting their diabetes or their blood pressure under control, somebody taking their MAT, medication-assisted treatment, for their opioid use disorder, and not selling it on the black market. We celebrate the small wins. But, you know, we're looking at Medicaid cuts hitting hard at the end of the year when those subsidies go away. And we have started in the nation, we have started to make improvements on overdose deaths in recent years. I think we're going to see it slide back up if those Medicaid cuts go away, because that has been the number one way that particularly young men have been able to access substance use treatment.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with New York Times bestselling author Beth Macy about her new book, Paper Girl, a memoir of home and family in a fractured America. Coming up, we're going to talk more about the role media is playing in America's political divide and how the loss of local reporting is expanding that divide. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Urbana native Beth Macy is a New York Times bestselling author. She's written books about the demise of factories to the rise of opioid addiction and death. She's the author of Dopesick, Dealers, Doctors, and the Drug Company That Addicted America, which also became a TV miniseries. And she's with us today to talk about the political divide in America through the lens of her hometown of Urbana, Ohio. The book is called Paper Girl, a memoir of home and family in a fractured America. Beth, thanks again for being here today.
Thanks, Amy.
So you are the paper girl in the title of your book, and you had a paper route as a kid. You wanted to use the money to buy clothes, and you wanted to be able to pay for a middle school trip to Washington, D.C. But did you have any idea when you were a paper girl that you would end up being a writer and a journalist?
I really didn't. I don't know that I read the paper. My parents read the paper. They watched Walter Cronkite. They listened to Channel 7. You know, a lot of people got the Columbus Dispatch on Sundays or the Springfield News Sun. We were a family of readers, but, you know, being a little kid, I wasn't that into the news. But I always say that being a paper girl taught me how to be a reporter, because you don't have to negotiate being a reporter. What's on the record, what's off. Like, you have to talk people into giving you an interview, giving you information. And a lot of that was like collecting on the route on the weekend when cheap customers would try to avoid you. I learned a lot from that. And I also was great friends with our mailman, Mr. Mosley, whose route intersected mine. And you just learn when you're doing a job like that, a service job, and it's every day, day in and day out, you know, unless you had somebody who could substitute for you. I mean, you just had to do it, even if you were sick. And it was great training for just having a good work ethic.
And a major theme in your book is the demise of local media and small town newspapers. That newspaper you delivered is nothing like it was back then. How has the lack of local news truly changed the mindset of many people who live in Urbana?
Yeah. Well, as we talked about before, people don't know what's going on in the schools. They don't know what's going on in their community. Everybody's in their bubble. I think this has exacerbated conspiracy theories, for one thing, and just a lack of basic empathy for the other. So most of my career, I was here at the Roanoke Times. It's a community of about 250,000 in the Roanoke Valley in Virginia. And I came here to be a feature writer at the Roanoke Times in 1989. There were 65 reporters. Can you guess how many they now have?
Five, I hope.
You're exactly right.
Okay.
So less than 10%.
I know. Well, I wanted to be like, I hope 10, but I think it's not. Yeah.
And when I left to write books in 2014, I hadn't had a raise in 8 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, my school teacher husband, we're living paycheck to paycheck, just like most of America. And we read the paper all the time. Now, they're just, those empathy building stories that told you who your neighbors were and who you were, warts and all, don't exist. I spent 6 years following the travails of a young woman who had grown up in the projects and wasn't just the first in her family to go to college. She was the first in her neighborhood to go, and she went to Harvard. Mm. I mean, that's a great story that builds empathy. When this first story ran, they called it the library's child because the library had helped raise her. Had helped her single mom help raise her. A hairdresser who was white and gay, Selena was black, made a fund where he collected money so that when Selena got to Harvard, where her roommate was the daughter of an Italian ambassador who brought a personal chef to college with her, wouldn't feel like a food stamp recipient in a line at Whole Foods. I mean, that was... The newspapers were the glue. You found out about the fire department fundraiser and who got a DUI. I'm trying to think of all the little funny things in the Urbana Citizen that we used to make fun of. Notes from Rosewood, which is a little tiny hamlet out in Champaign County, where you would find that John Smith had visited his Aunt Matilda in Columbus. And, you know, that was in the newspaper. And I've always thought the newspaper is the glue. I maybe have a rose-colored glasses view about it, but I love the work. And as James Baldwin said, if you can change the way people think about something, even by a millimeter, you will have changed the world a little bit. And I really saw what I did as public service. I wrote this year-long series about teen pregnancy in 1993. When Roanoke had the highest rate in Virginia, which was unusual because we're a smaller city. And the city formed a task force. And 3 years later, they had all these social supports in place and the rate went down. I mean, that was a direct effect of my reporting. And there simply aren't enough people and the capacity for that kind of really good investigative reporting is all but gone.
Yeah, and there's also, I mean, you mentioned this a little bit in the book. There's also the problem of the news that is left. It has a lot of it sometimes has paywalls, and so if there's news being reported, the people who maybe need to read it the most can't read it because it's behind a paywall.
Exactly. What comes with your cable package? Fox News and Newsmax.
Right.
So that's all my relatives watch and listen to. And that's the only story they see. And it all started when Reagan abolished the Fairness Doctrine that made it so that broadcasters had to air opposing views. They don't have to do that anymore. And then when the internet explodes and takes away advertising with digital, we didn't get out ahead of our skis on that, and we didn't regulate it so that things that... lies spreading so quickly on social media, Facebook isn't held accountability. Facebook isn't held to account for the lies and what they've done to this country.
I'll just take a moment to toot public radio's own horn, though. No paywall here, you know. So
Absolutely. We
do the best we can, but we don't even have five reporters. I can tell you that much. This is all sides.
Can I just put in a plug for the Ohio Capital Journal?
Oh,
which
yeah.
Your nonprofit state's newsroom, it's in all 50 states, they are killing it. They've hired a lot of dislocated, laid off newspaper reporters from legacy newspapers. and they're doing a really good job, as are you guys. I mean, we need to support the local news that we have. I think that's really, really important. In Roanoke, where I live, the Roanoke Times is a shadow of itself, but we also have a couple of online startups. And Cardinal News, which is our nonprofit one, now has 12 reporters. It has double, more than double what the Roanoke Times has. So there are these models out there, but a lot of people don't even know about them. Like when I was interviewing people in Urbana, only one person I talked to knew about the Ohio Capital Journal. So I think it's really important to support local radio, local public TV, these nonprofits, because these folks are doing the Lord's work. They really are. They're as David DeWitt, the editor at Ohio Capital Journal, he says, people think we're left-leaning, but we're just small D democracy. We're just trying to get the information out there about what's really going on.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with New York Times bestselling author Beth Macy about her new book, Paper Girl, a memoir of home and family in a fractured America. You've done a lot of interviews in your career with a lot of different people, powerful people, but you wrote that interviewing your conservative older sister Cookie for this book was the interview that you were the most nervous about. Why was that?
Well, because I knew hard things were going to come up. We were going to talk about some really hard things that had happened with her children, who I'm very close to, one in particular, and they were abused when they were abused by her husband, and that my mom and I both reported it to the police. We begged the town to take it seriously, and charges were never filed because the prosecutor stood in the way, because he was in cahoots with the minister at Cookie's Evangelical Church. And so we talked about that. And then at the end of the conversation, it had actually gone remarkably well. I said, Cookie, Max, who's my oldest son, was about to get married to his husband. And I said, Max thinks you don't like him because he's gay. And she said quickly, I love him. I don't like that he's gay. I pray for him. And then all the little techniques I had learned about building bridges, because I'd done a lot of interviews with experts about how to conduct these interviews with people who live in totally different information ecosystems, including in our families, it all went out the window when it was my own kid. And we got in this big tit for tat. And I finally thought of Mr. Rogers saying, use your words. And I said, Cookie, I'm getting mad. You can see my face is red. If we're going to have any relationship at all, I guess we can't talk about that. But that was very painful. I mean, a lot of the interviews were just painful. An interviewer asked me recently, what was the predominant emotion of going back? And I said, I had to say, it was pain. Some weeks I would rent an Airbnb for the full week, and I would leave at the end of day four, so I could come back and be with my dog and my husband and my friends that think exactly the way I do, right? Mm-hmm. I don't feel guilty about that, but you can just do what you can do. And I get all the time I get at my book events, help, Thanksgiving's coming. Do I go? And I'm like, yes, do go. You don't have to spend the whole day, but go and try to remember who you are as people. And what can you still celebrate in your family? And in our family, it's our mom, who was just so remarkable and so funny and feisty. And it was, food and card games and fishing. And what are the things that still make you the Macy family? Like, what can you uphold without bringing politics into every discussion?
And just to end on, your mom was worried about you writing about depressing subjects. She wanted you to write a love story. This book is probably not the love story she had in mind, but I think, is there a little bit of a love story for Urbana in this book?
Oh my gosh, I hope people in Urbana see it as a love story. I love this town. I'm grateful to this town. It made me who I am, warts and all. My mom would ask me that over and over because she had dementia. She said, what are you working on now? Now I'm writing a second book about the heroin epidemic. And then she would say it over and over, you should write a love story. And the heroes in this book are my mom and, people like Brooke Perry, the truancy officer, and Lance Jackson, the retired teacher who spends every day after school trying to help kids who've dropped out, get their lives back on track. There are a lot of heroes in this book, a lot of really good people in town. I just would like to see the scale of the helpers rise to the level of the scale of the problems so we could begin to get our communities back on track.
And we have less than a minute left, but what gives you the most hope? Is it the people like Brooke that you mentioned and the teachers that are there?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. David M. Sapp, director of bands, you know, mm-hmm. just killing it. You know, the band is now so tiny, they can no longer spell Hill Climbers, which is his team name. Mm-hmm. They can only script out at halftime the word Ohio. I hope they don't go to OH, the abbreviation for Ohio. But David Sapp, somebody read my piece about Silas in the New York Times and has now donated thousands of dollars to help poor kids get equipment for the Urbana High School marching band. I mean, that's because David Sapp is amazing. And we need to celebrate those teachers and those heroes in our community.
Journalist Beth Macy, author of the new book, Paper Girl, a memoir of home and family in a fractured America. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Amy. I really enjoyed it.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich. Thanks for joining us.